Good to see each and every one of you that's here tonight, and I certainly appreciate very much the invitation to come and to be a part of this Bible study, preacher study, however we may call it. I've heard about it, and we've heard many good things about it, and so it's a pleasure to be here. Wish we could have came to be here during the whole of the meeting, and then certainly in the future we would love to make plans to do that. I appreciate so much, Bart. We have talked for a long time about many things. This is just one subject of many we discuss, and I appreciate him because it's not every day we get a chance to share some of our struggles, really. And I think he talked about that just a little bit in the question and answer. Is when you come up through the sciences, especially at the university levels, you're just being overwhelmed with information. And at times, you're able to see through some of the issues that are being presented to you as if they're fact, and yet they're based on a number of hypotheses and premises, but they're not very clear or come outright and state such. And so you have to struggle through those things, and it is a struggle. And I feel very, very fortunate to be in a position that I am today. Individuals who I've been able to talk to over the years and to share ideas openly, knowing that I wasn't going to face persecution for sharing ideas, even if I knew others wouldn't be in agreement with those things. And I'll talk about a little bit of those as we go through some of these, because there are a number of different ways of trying to wrangle with the scriptures and trying to come to an understanding of how a hermeneutical approach to looking at the scriptures fits into some of the observations we make in the scientific community and some of the things that have been stated as being supposedly factual or true. And of course, we have to work through a lot of those things, and that's where faith really is a challenge. And I appreciate that Bart talked about faith, because that's the critical element. That's what we want to get across, is we all have a common faith. We're all working towards the same goals, but sometimes we see things a little bit differently. And in science, we enjoy different views. We don't look at that necessarily as a negative. We look at it as a positive, because as iron sharpens iron, we get the opportunity to really not only hone our skills, but hone our interpretations, and really get to the point of understanding truth to the best we possibly can. And so that's a process. And so I appreciate what Brother Bart has presented. And what I will present is a bit differing. There are things about what he presented I find very interesting, and we'll look forward to go home and study more. And I appreciate already the questions that will be coming later on. And we don't want you to hold back. Ask questions. And we certainly enjoy the questions, because we're all trying to get to the point of truth and understanding it to the best of our ability. And sometimes your perspective and your questions helps us a lot in honing the things we present, not only tonight, but in the future as well. Tonight, for just a little while, I'm going to be talking about the fossil record in its entirety. It's not to say we won't dismiss dinosaurs. I will talk about dinosaurs. That's the main crux of the conversation that we're having here this evening, is talking about the dinosaurs. That's where a lot of this information began, is a lesson I gave on dinosaurs, similar to other lessons that others have given. You can find YouTubes about supposed coexistence of dinosaurs and human, that there is some there are some observations out there in history. There are various things we find even in nature that cause us to ask questions about that. And so that is something you can go and you can look at. I'm not going to regurgitate that material tonight. I'm going to go beyond that and build not necessarily a blow-for-blow counter to Bart's points, but I'm going to stick to some things I've put together to help you with a perspective that I think helps us to see how the fossil record works in a biblical worldview and how we ultimately get to that. And of course, we will answer that question, is did the dinosaurs ever roam the earth, then cease to exist? I think that's also a point, too, that came out in the discussion earlier, is did dinosaurs actually ever live? And so we need to ask that question and consider that as well. All right. So there are a couple of ancient views about fossils, and we'll talk about fossils in general because that's where we need to begin. There are a number of ancient views about fossils, and Bart talked on a couple of those, but fossils have certain shapes, and so the shapes have been interpreted to mean different things, such as this crinoid. People thought in ancient history that this was a fallen star. It was literally captured somehow in the rock record. Just because it has a star shape, that doesn't necessarily make it true, but it's an interesting view, and it was one that was shared by the ancients. Aristotle speculated that ancient fish must have swam into the cracks of the rock and got stuck. He proposed those views at around 350 BC. And of course, we know that that's not correct. Even in the biblical context, there are those who have proposed and said, hey, they have found seashells on high mountaintops. We'll look at Mount Everest here in a few minutes, and we'll look at it as an example. But they find seashells in inner remote regions, deserts, and things of that nature. And so individuals have speculated this must be leftover materials from the Noah flood, as recorded in Genesis 6, 7, and 8. We also find that there are those who propose that they're just simply pranks of nature. They are works of the devil or even supernatural representations of ideal life forms. Yes, think about aliens. Those are the kinds of ideas that were postulated throughout time. But it was during the Renaissance that naturalists like Leonardo da Vinci hypothesized fossils were once living organisms. And of course, the timing of these kinds of thoughts as they progressed ultimately resulted in this, the geologic column. And the geologic column is simply a fossil record put into the context of time. Now, of course, that's one of the elements that we would debate is whether it's actual time or if it's just relative time. But the idea is that individuals like Hooke, Steno, Hutton, Lyell, and Darwin helped to formulate this idea because they were all bringing out ideas that worked together to ultimately establish things such as stratigraphy, the idea of how rocks are stacked, how the formations of various geologic elements come together, the superposition of those materials, and that the older material must be on bottom, the younger material must be on top. Just think about pickup sticks in the games that we play. A uniformitarianism, the idea that things continue to be and continue to process as we see them today, and that really doesn't change. And of course, that's how we get to very ancient ages, such as age of the earth at 4.65 billion years. And then, of course, evolution is at the center of that. And that helps helps scientists to put together and formulate really the fossil record and how the relationship between the species found in the fossil record or the geologic record ultimately play forward into the species we see today. As we look in the box, we're looking at the Mesozoic era. The Mesozoic era is the era of dinosaurs. Before that, there was early elements of species of reptiles. But dinosaurs are not associated necessarily with reptiles, even though a lot of people thought that in the early days. We see that also there is an entire period. Of course, that period goes from 65 million years to 245 million years. So it's about the first or the last quarter of a billion years. And I know these numbers are big, but it's the last supposed quarter of a billion years, again, out of over 4.5 billion-year-old Earth. But life really, according to paleontologists and those that promote evolution, life really had an explosive time in the Cambrian, which started at about 500 million years ago, 570 million years ago, and that's called the Paleozoic period. And so the Paleozoic period is a predecessor to the Mesozoic, where we find the dinosaurs. And of course, we're in the Cenozoic, where more modern mammals and things are supposedly found in the geologic record. The reason I bring this up is to put into context, is there's been a lot of things before the dinosaurs. There are a lot of things concurrent with the dinosaurs. And of course, there are things that came after the dinosaurs. So we have to appreciate the whole of the fossil record and to understand where fossils came from, so that we can consider whether or not fossils have always been a part of the geologic record and never really lived, or if they actually did live, and then, of course, then how do we deal with that in context of the scriptures? Well, there are multiple origin theories out there today. And what I'm going to propose is and show you is just examples of origin theories who believe in God. These are theistic views. And when you start to look at theistic views of origin, you're not just talking about origin, you're talking about the fossil theories that go along with them, because that has to fit somehow into that context. But when you look at these theories, there are many many ancient earth theories that still identify God as God, that they are a theistic element to these origin theories. And I'll say, from a personal standpoint, as one who went through and learned geology and saw all the complexities that geoscience brings to the table with the age of the earth, I'd been through the biologic sciences and the chemistry and things of that nature, and I dealt with evolution, and I felt like that was a little easier to deal with. When I got to geology, I thought to myself, what do I have on my hands? Because this is really hard and very difficult to get my head around. And so in that, any of these theories, and I certainly looked at them and entertained them, because they would have been really easy to adopt. They would have been really easy to adopt because that would have been the easiest solution to dealing with ancient Earth and some of the things I saw, even some of the evolutionary elements that are proposed, and then the Bible and the Scriptures. But then, thankfully, brethren came along that talked to me and was willing to share with me, and did so in a very non-combative way that I extremely appreciated. Brother Jimmy Kading was a very instrumental person in my development during that period. We would bounce ideas off of one another, and he would say, well, don't forget, you know, how the word day is used in the Hebrew. And we would have very good discussions and rebuttals on those things, and that helped me a lot to realize that ancient earth view does not fit within the biblical context. You can't force that to work. And so that's not what we're going to discuss tonight, but I just want you to be aware this is a very complex situation. The main point of ancient earth views is to really find a way to make evolution and even a creation view from a biblical worldview ultimately unite, to come together and somehow coalesce. And it's just not possible. Those who try to force it are overlooking some very basic things when it comes to scriptural interpretation. And so even in Mark chapter 10 and verse 6, Jesus himself who spoke said, but from the beginning of the creation. He doesn't just say beginning to put in a human context. He says the creation. He says, from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. When he makes this statement, even though we think about the union of man and woman in marriage, he is also saying they were created in the beginning of creation. And so there's no room for millions or billions of years in the time frame before mankind came to exist if you believe in the creative story found in the book of Genesis. And more so if you believe in Jesus Christ as co-creator of all things according to John chapter 1, you can't dismiss his words here because they are meaningful to the Christian and their faith. And so we can't discount Jesus. If we discount Jesus, you might as well discount everything. And so we need to be very cautious about that. But what we're going to talk about, and it was stated earlier, is really a young earth viewpoint. And there are two. The two that we've looked at here this evening began with the apparent age theory, and we'll look at a literal application of the Genesis account in chapter 1, as well as then obviously the flood, the follow-up that came later in chapters 6 through 8. Now, when we look at this young earth perspective, we have to ask this very simple question. What is the difference between these? And I thought about that a lot. I've thought about this for a while now and really tried to consider is there are parts of the apparent age I really like. There are things about it that are very meaningful. But then I've read some things that are interesting too, is to really to make comparison between, is it just agedness or is it maturity? And then there's even a debate between those two words. Just because something is mature when it's created doesn't necessarily make it aged. We define agedness. We're the ones that put that in a particular context. Of course, even as Bart showed earlier, you can see something full grown, mature, and it is mature, yes, but is it necessarily aged? No, it's brand new. It was just created. And so Adam and Eve, when they came together, you know, they didn't see each other as older, mature individuals. No, they just saw each other as just simply that, mature, full-grown, adult. Agedness had nothing to do with it. But let's look at, just for a moment, the idea of the difference between these views, because there is one really important element, I think, that makes these two stand apart. First of all, Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And of course, we know the rest of that account. And I'm going to just give it a really high-level, brief summation. But when you look at this literal day view, of course, I don't know what name to really apply to this view. It's just the view I've always taken. Bart mentioned that it might be maybe a Morris view, such as after Henry and John Morris of their writings in days ago. But this idea, this literal approach, is that I see is that earth formed. That's the beginning. That's Genesis 1:1, no doubt. Then life was created, and that comes through the rest of chapter 1. And in fact, when we look at that, we see on day 3, the grass, the plants, the trees, all vegetation is created. And of course, that's out of order with the evolutionary account. And so that's one main problem with trying to bring in theistic evolution. Then on day 5, aquatic life and the birds were created. And then day 6, then land animals and humans were created. That's the Genesis 1 account, literal, from the life creation. Then we note that then came a global flood in the days of Noah. There was a massive burial of those life forms, those things that did not survive the flood. That's in this particular view. And then the fossils had to be formed from that massive burial. That's the perspective I'll be showing in some of the proof that I think supports that. But as we look at apparent age in comparison, just so we realize where the difference is that the earth formed, yes, same, but then in situ or in place, fossils and the strata, as we find in the geologic column, as Bart noted, even in the Grand Canyon, all of that was created in place. Then life was created, and then there was a nominal flood impact in fossil formation. It really wasn't as big or meaningful an impact. And of course, I would think, we don't think big enough in global scale. If there truly was a global flood, it would have a humongously catastrophic effect. We'll talk about that here in just a moment. But the key is here, is when did these fossils form? When do we fit that into the scriptures? And I believe it's right there in Genesis 1:1. It has to fit here where the word earth is found, the old terra firma. It has to be associated with this verse, because how else would you get it to fit in a biblical context? Where would you bring it in and introduce this idea? So the fossils, as well as the strata, are just purely, by definition, geologic. They are just part of the geologic record. Those fossils that are found, whether they be carbonized or calcified, they are minerals, they are a part of the rock record, they are a part of the rock. So let's define them as such. If you look at the apparent age view, fossil is just simply part of the rock record. That's it. We can't apply other things to it. And I'll show you that that isn't consistent with what we know about fossils. So, again, the literal day and flood view, obviously, catastrophism. That's the basic premise of that model. The big difference, I think, between these views is uniformitarianism. And uniformitarianism is the proponent that we get the appearance of things that make sense from an ancient age or age-construed model. And so it looks old. And if it looks old, there must be processes that ultimately led to making it look old. And so, if Adam had a navel, Adam had scars, Adam had wrinkles, it's because that would have been apparent to what would have been relevant to the process of life itself. And if you're going to put stratification together and stratigraphy together and all of these other elements, including a fossil record, then you have to look at it from a uniformitarian view. And that changes everything in what we first proposed, is that ancient earth and young earth are supposedly the juxtaposition. But I would propose to you that if you actually made this a uniformitarian and catastrophism approach and compared the two, actually apparent age doesn't fit in the bottom group. It actually fits in the upper group. And that creates a tremendous paradox. And the paradox simply is this. You have something that is young that looks very old. That's the paradox. It's not old. It's young, but yet it appears old. I will share this with you because I found it interesting as I was reading through scriptures and thinking about this, but You know, uniformitarianism is shared in the scriptures. In 2 Peter chapter 3 and verses 3 through 12, it says that in the last days, scoffers are going to come and say that all things as have been since the beginning just continue. That's the essence of a uniformitarian view. There is no change. There's no disruption in a particular flow or the appearance of a particular flow. But yet, catastrophism will certainly not only be a part of what was the flood, but will be a part of the very end when this earth and all of the universe is burned up in a fervent heat. A couple of principles to remember. Some of these Bart mentioned earlier, but the one that stands out to me the most is 1 Corinthians 14, verse 33. God is not the author of confusion. And that's a part of the paradox problem that I have. Something that is young looks old, and if we were to go out and make an observation, we would say it's old. And so how are we to get to the point and conclusion of saying that it's young? And more importantly, as we'll get to at the end of our lesson, is how do we ultimately find ourselves accountable to the knowledge of God as a creator if we are confused as to whether or not there was a creator? A couple of other verses to think about, such as Deuteronomy 29:29. The secret things belong to the Lord our God. There's just simply things we're not going to be privy to, and we need to remember that no matter what we study, no matter what position we take. I think Bart alluded to this. We don't want to be dogmatic about these things. We're presenting views, and our views are susceptible to change based on the evidence that is brought forth. And certainly, we are open to looking at other evidences. But there are some things that are revealed to us, as this verse also says, and we have the ability to understand some things. Isaiah 55, verse 9, he noted this one. Certainly, we know God's ways and thoughts are certainly higher than our own. And I love Romans 3 and 4. You may say, well, that's out of context, but I love the statement anyway. Let God be true, but every man a liar. The point really is, at the end of the day, we don't get to speak for God. We don't know everything about God. And if we propose a view, we're probably going to find out in eternity it isn't perfect anyway. But that's the point we understand and we appreciate, is that God is God. We need to remember to put him in his place. And from Job 38, especially in verse 3, I love it, when he asked Job the question, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? And of course, Job wasn't there. Job wasn't there. We weren't there. None of us were there. And that's what we're talking about. Things that were formed supposedly at the foundation of the earth and then processes later, as we mentioned in the Q&A just a little bit earlier, is simply, there are things that took place on a global scale for years before the flood and for probably many years after the flood, before globalization occurred and people moved about, that we have no idea what happened. And there is no record of it. We have no idea what was going on. And so it is really presumptuous of to assume we know all of those answers. But we also know, I think I'm hitting the laser button. There we go. That we can come and reason, and we can come to have understanding of things. We have a mind. God gave us a mind. It is an empowering thing if we use it the right way, and it's certainly a destructive thing if we use it the wrong way. So let me dive into the fossil record and talk about it from really a, guess what? I didn't start my timer, so I've got a whole hour to go. No, we're going to move quickly. We're not going to keep you all night. So, but it is 50 seconds still left to go. All right. What is a fossil? Let's start with these basic questions. And I appreciate it earlier. There was a couple of questions asked. We're very basic. And we may have jumped a little too far in some things. We should have probably backed up to make sure everybody's on the same page. And I'm glad I at least covered this much, because hopefully this helps us to realize what fossils are and to appreciate it in the context of what we're talking about here this evening. The simplest definition that I could find was it's just simply the preserved remains of a prehistoric organism. Well, what does prehistoric organism mean? Well, by definition, it means something that was previously alive. And so when you talk about a fossil, that's why I made the point in making the comparison between apparent age and looking at this more literal approach is that a fossil's not a fossil in apparent age. It wasn't previously living. So therefore, it can't be a fossil by the definition we use today. But in this element that I want to share with you, I believe fossils are previously living organisms, and I believe there's a lot of proof of that out there. And when we think about fossils, we think about such as this Triceratops. We think about the bone structure. We think about the remnants that we can see in various museums that we can stand in awe of and think about this animal, this creature, and how magnificent and how awesome it must have been. But this is really the simplified approach of how we think about fossils. Fossils are much more than this. And when you think about the study of these fossils, they tell us more than this as well. So I want to look at the term fossil a little deeper. The term fossil comes from the Latin, which means dug up or simply brought out of the ground or unearthed. It describes a wide range of natural historic artifacts. A fossil is any evidence of past plant or animal life that is preserved in the earth. There are primarily two types of fossils when you define them. There is what are called body fossils, which are fossilized remains or impressions. And then there are trace fossils, and they are the remnants of various activities of ancient life as well. Now, when we look at these as a whole, it's called paleontology, or the study of ancient life. So again, another term that can't really be applied or is very useful in a apparent age, because there is no ancient life that we're studying in the fossil record, but yet this is what we find in today's studies in geoscience. The process of fossilization. Brandon commented a little bit about fossilization a little bit earlier, and I want to clarify a couple things about fossilization by answering these questions. Number one, how does it occur? Number two, what are they made of? Number three, how long does it take? Number four, how quickly are they preserved? And I'll answer those questions by looking at them in the context of showing you a number of examples of these body and trace fossils so that you can understand and appreciate when you see them. Now, tonight, my plan was to have a whole table of fossils. They're all over in our wrecked truck in the Home Depot parking lot. So later, if you need to shop at Home Depot and have time to come by my truck, we'll look at some fossils together. But we wanted to show them, but these are some examples that we'll still show plenty of illustrations. So when you go on to the computer and you Google search fossils, you're going to see things and you're going to be able to at least start thinking about fossils a little bit differently so as to understand how these fossils are identified, but also what do they tell us? And we'll get to that here in just a few minutes. The first type is called an unaltered body remain. An unaltered body remain can be such as this: insects trapped in amber, which is simply tree sap that's crystallized and entrapped them in some sort of fossil record context. What's the premise of this? Well, we should all know. This comes from Jurassic Park. They talk about it. They talk about how you can take these preserved elements, and if they were around in the time of dinosaurs in the Mesozoic, you can tap in there and get some dino DNA. And that dino DNA can help us restructure and maybe recreate dinosaurs. Well, as Bart showed in some pictures earlier, we don't want that. We don't want to be face-to-face with a T-Rex. Don't want to be face-to-face with some of these animals, because certainly cohabitating with them is going to be extremely challenging for us. But you know, there's other unaltered body remains, such as this baby woolly mammoth. This baby woolly mammoth was ultimately unaltered, but yet it is a fossil. It is fossil by context and fossil by definition. And so this woolly mammoth tells us a lot. It looks much like we would find in a mummified remain of even humans. Of course, some people try to draw out the context and say, well, no, fossils have to at least be 10,000 years old. And you'll find that sometimes on the internet. That's not a part of its definition. Age is not a part of the definition. It's a part of the preservation that ultimately defines it. And so preserved elements, our preservers, can be amber, such as we see at the top. It could be the tar pits, such as La Brea tar pits in Los Angeles. And it can be Arctic-type settings, such as was the case for this woolly mammoth. Now, the point of it is they don't go through bacterial alteration or decay. They don't get consumed. They aren't in necessarily oxic conditions where ultimately oxygen helps in the breakdown of certain molecular elements. These things are unaltered and helps us to understand, like for instance, what a woolly mammoth may have looked like based on the fur that's preserved. Its skin texture and tones. A lot of things can be determined from this particular element. So we'll talk about some things pertaining to unaltered elements, and they were already introduced earlier, such as through dinosaurs. And we'll talk about that implication here in a few minutes. Then there is what's called altered body remains. And altered body remains are just as it proposes in its name. These are things that have undergone some kind of chemical change. It is called permineralization. And in permineralization, the calcium phosphate, for instance, that makes up most of a bone, is ultimately exchanged for some other chemical element due to its reaction and interaction with groundwater and the chemistry of minerals around it. You can see in the top right, the dinosaur has been calcified. So now you have a calcite element. You see in the bottom, the fish, it's a nice rusty color. Well, that's because it's now altered to hematite, an iron element. In the right, and even then on the left, you see some carbonization of ammonites and trilobites. And so these are ultimately a mineral exchange for the original materials. But they are no longer original. They just simply preserve and help you see, especially the hard body parts, such as bones and shells. Then the question comes up, and often comes up, how long does this process take? Well, it depends on a couple of things. But let me give you an example so that we can appreciate this, because these kinds of examples have been given many times, and people have witnessed these things. Let's take, for example, the case of a crab. You're walking along a shore one day. You see a crab. What typically do you see if the crab dies? Well, this is disgusting, but I know. You'll see a decaying crab. That crab is ultimately undergoing a number of processes. It's being oxygenated. It's undergoing a microbial breakdown of its tissue and elements. It is also being plucked at and eaten by birds. It's also going through a mechanical decomposition because the wave action may be beating against it. The pebbles, the shells, the sand are beating and grinding against it, so mechanically breaks down that way. And even air can blow hard enough that the sand may be abrasive towards it. Well, all those things ultimately lead to decay. But if the situation is that crab is rapidly buried and does not decay, is taken away from oxygen, taken away from things that can ultimately eat it, under the right conditions, chemically, it can go through a preservation process and it can be permineralized. And individuals have seen these things happen in the course of literally just a few days to weeks and months. And they can go back, they can dig these things up, and they can see it themselves, and there's been experiments done on it. It's a quick process. It has to be a quick process, a rapid process. Because if this is not a rapid process, we don't have fossils. And so the question is, can we have fossilization occurring today, and can it happen rapidly? Yes, and there are numerous examples of it. You can see these things happening in nature today. Then there's another type of a fossil called casts and molds, and of course, you can see the pairing of them in the top right. The far right there is a trilobite mold or cast, and then you see the mold of that trilobite. Literally, the rock has been split in half, and you see its body impression on the other side. You see seashells down in the bottom right, which are simply brachiopods in the Austin Chalk, and then over on the left, you see the remains of some carbonization, but mainly impression of a particular fern leaf. Now, the question becomes, do we have casts and molds of other things that are more interesting? Yes, we do. How about human beings? How about animals that live with human beings? In the bottom left, you see a dog with his collar. In the top left, you actually see a human. If you look really hard in the top right, sadly, you see a small child. This was discovered and unearthed in Pompeii during an eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD. That'd be towards the end of the New Testament period. There was a major eruption overnight, and a huge volcanic ash plume came racing down the mountain and literally buried the city of Pompeii. Many things have been found archaeologically after this massive eruption and the unearthing of this city in years gone by. But some of the most amazing things have been these molds of human beings. Human beings, animals, all kinds of things, literally in their positions where they were sleeping at the time. They are literally fossilized remains. And there are things we can learn from these fossils about what they were doing at the time of their fossilization. And certainly we can understand a lot about even the animals and some of the contexts that go along with them as well. But you know what? There's also casts that are out there, and we find many of them as far as human footprints. The bottom, we see a set of footprints across a volcanic ash bed near Vesuvius in Napoli, Italy. It's supposedly around 500 BC. And then if you use the interpretations given by anthropologists, there is this footprint in the top right that is on a particular mudstone of supposedly a human being walking across a lake bed near Wollondra Lakes in Australia. These are also referred to, these footprints are also referred to as what's called trace fossils. And trace fossils talk a lot about the mobility of certain things in the ancient times. These are trace fossils. They're just simply burrows. You see both cast and mold. And what it is representative of, even though it looks like worms, it's actually small critters, bugs, things like that, that literally burrowed through soft sediment, typically on the bottom of an ocean in a marine setting, or at least near a shoreline. And these remnants represent many particular animals that have been moving through the mud and scurrying about and creating these little burrow holes. A good example of that is shrimp burrows. You can find shrimp burrows today, and they can be preserved in a relatively short amount of time. Shrimp burrow through the sand, both vertically and horizontally. And you get, sometimes in this case, you'll see a hematite remnant of the burrow itself infilling the hole. Or as you can see in the hand in the bottom right, it can literally be plucked out of that sand, and it is a fossil. It is a representation of what the burrow would have looked like if ultimately casted. So what do these fossils tell us? Well, I think you're probably starting to get a little bit of a hint is what they're telling us, but we'll look at them a little more dynamically. First of all, they tell us about what I believe is prehistoric species. They are prehistory. They are some point in time, we are not familiar with when they exactly were laid down, but they were found in the sediments. The case is whether they were found catastrophically in the flood in Noah's day, or the question then becomes too, another hypothesis is presented tonight, is were they never existent? Are they truly non-existent things that just belong in the rock? The rock system, the earth system, terra firma, not necessarily a predecessory element of life. Well, in this case, there's a three representatives here, a very commonly known thing such as trilobites. There's also some echinoderms up there as well, starfish. But that would be from the Paleozoic era, the ancient part of life when life first began, and they are now extinct, the trilobites. Then, of course, we have the Mesozoic with dinosaurs, now extinct. And then even in the recent, the Pleistocene, part of the Cenozoic, saber-toothed cat, extinct. And, of course, many things of that period are extinct today, such as woolly mammoths and other things as well. The key is there are multitudes. It was commented earlier that literally there are many more species that are extinct and in the fossil record today than are actually alive and in existence today. But what we also find is that they are extinct. They are non-living today. We don't find them around today. When we find them, it's interesting. We usually find them in massive burials. When we think about fossils, we often think about that iconic figure that we'll see at a museum, such as a dinosaur. And we'll think about a particular dig where they're unearthing it. Well, usually when you find these things, and including with dinosaurs, you'll find them in massive burial settings. There won't be just one. There'll be many. They may be scattered across a large area, but there are typically many. And in some of these pictures, such as in the top and here on the left, many of them are marine. There are more marine fossils, things in the waters or the oceans, than there are of any type of fossil. And we'll see just how abundant they are in a moment. And then, like in this one in China, this is a particular dinosaur graveyard found in Zhoushan. And there they found some 7,600 dinosaur species deposited in what's interpreted a massive catastrophic flood environment. That's what the stratigraphy tells us. It tells us that it had to be some sort of huge regional element of some sort of flood event. Now, when I think about that, I can't help but think about Genesis 7 and 4, when in the days of Noah, God said, I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things, that I have made. And so there wasn't going to be local pockets of animals surviving. Obviously, the earth had to be completely covered based on the things that we read about in this account. But the point is, what did not enter the ark died. What didn't enter the ark died. And we'll see just how massive that could possibly be here in a moment. But in this particular case, many of us are familiar with the White Cliffs of Dover. We know about the White Cliffs of Dover not only because of their beauty, but also because of their historical significance during the time of World War II. But when you look at these cliffs, they are hundreds of feet high. And of course, they extend not just at the surface of the water, they extend downward. Well, the real question is what makes up this particular rock? And if you don't know, let me show it to you under a scanning electron microscope. It's called coccoliths. And coccoliths are microscopic animals, marine animals. In essence, these coccoliths make up what's called chalk. And it's not like the processed chalk today that you use on a chalkboard, but like back in the day when you had chalk, when you wrote on your blackboard or your green board, you were smearing little dead animals all over it. Think about it that way. But coccoliths are these really small microscopic elements. That entire cliff face. Now, it was said earlier that there are literally billions of fossils out there. I guarantee you, you can't come up with a big enough number of how many fossils are in just this formation here. It's enormous. It's enormous. But all the White Cliffs of Dover are made up of fossils. It's a fossiliferous chalk. And it's amazing to think about how much life had to be preserved and buried in a sediment setting to preserve that much life. In Genesis 1 and 20, God said, "Let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures." So in the beginning, there was an abundance of living creatures. The Bible doesn't say there was an abundance of life-like creatures or things preserved in a fossil record. None of that can be found. When we think about, too, in the context of Psalm 104:25, reading from the NIV, it says, "There is a sea vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number, living things both large and small." Well, these little coccoliths are still getting buried today and lots of other things just like them on our sea bottoms. Here's Mount Everest. Of course, people have talked about, well, there are fossils on Mount Everest. Have you heard? Well, here's a picture of some of them. They look like little seashells. They're brachiopods. And so the thing that many people thought about when they originally thought about fossils being found on Mount Everest, what apologeticists tried to promote is this. Psalm 104, verses 6 and 7, "The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled." When the waters increased above the mountains, these creatures, these species, must have been deposited during the flood. But that's not the case. They're already concreted into limestone. It's a fossiliferous limestone. It's stacked on top of a fossiliferous shale. So there's your limestone, a little dolomite. There's a big shale system. And then underneath that, you get into big granites. Well, the top of that is based out of a fossiliferous limestone. It's literally chock full of fossils. So it had to be preserved in the rock according to the fossilization process first. Then it had to be uplifted. And of course, we call that plate tectonics. We think about various mountain ranges that have been supposedly uplifted according to geologic time. Well, I believe the answer to that's in the Bible. In Psalm 104, verse 8, according to the Revised Standard Version, and it reads slightly different than the King James, New King James, but it says, "The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place which you established for them." Now, in the King James, New King James, it tries to put it in the context that the water flowed over the mountains. But if you read it in the original, if you go back to the Hebrew, it just simply says, "Mountains rose, valleys sank." And that's the proper context to think about this. I believe it has something to do with plate tectonics. I think there was amazing things going on underneath the flood and possibly even after the flood. There may have been things going on from the time of creation to the flood if they were in remote parts of the world that there were no inhabitants and safety was not an issue. We don't know. And it's certainly presumptuous to say that absolutely that must have happened. But it's a possibility. When we think about coal, and of course this picture is from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, where U.S. gets a lot of its electrical power supply, is the burning of coal in our power plants. Here we have coal formation. Literally tens if not sometimes hundreds of feet thick, and over huge expanses of many counties, for instance, in this region. It's a lot of material. Well, what is it? Well, coal is a fossil fuel. We know that by definition. Why do we call it a fossil fuel? It's made of fossils. It's made of plant material, plant debris, all compressed, stacked, pressurized, and then ultimately transforms into either anthracite-type coal or other types of coal as well. They go through some kind of preservation process and alteration process as well. But we see the impressions. We see the texture. We see fossil representatives of plant material found in coal. When I think about it, I think about Genesis 6:17, where it says, "Everything that is on the earth shall die." You know, it wasn't just the animals that died on the face of the earth during the flood. It had to include all life, including the vegetative life. And when I think about that, and I think about, for instance, what we see in the remnants of even Mount St. Helens and Spirit Lake and all of the logs that are floating in mass, I think about things like the trash islands that are floating out in the ocean just from plastics that have blown out or washed out to sea. And you think about if a flood occurred and literally everything is wiped out on the surface and you get it floating debris massing together and then later it's deposited and buried and compressed and under a lot of water, then can you get coal formation? You can hypothesize it. I have no proof of it. But you certainly can hypothesize it, and you can start understanding why it could be. But more importantly, you can understand why it can be in places that don't make sense, like this coal seam that was recently discovered in Antarctica. Antarctica, the last time I looked, is not in a tropical region that's going to support a lot of plant life. And yet we have large, thick sections of coal in Antarctica. So either plate tectonics move the continents, maybe moved it a lot faster, which is still a difficult idea and model to work around, or floating masses ultimately were deposited and then buried under other sediments that were in the waters. So when we looked at the fossil record, we find examples, for instance, of fossils with fish. And when you think about what's with the fish, and you talk about swimming with the fishes, well, things like horses in the Cenozoic, that's a recent last tens of millions of years. That one's 50 million years old. The Mesozoic, the time of dinosaurs. This one is actually on display at ICR down in Texas on their wall in their Dallas offices. And then in the bottom left, Cenozoic with a palm leaf. And of course, fish are entrapped in these deposits. We find lots of these things. We find them throughout the world. And they cause us to ask questions. One thing most people aren't aware of is in the geologic record. Most of the geologic record is representative of what we call a fluvial environment. Rocks and sediments were deposited in a water-rich environment. Whether it be ocean, lake, stream, some sort of reservoir, it's all based on interpretation. But one thing's for sure, geologists agree, it is in a fluvial environment we find many of these sediments and fossils. And of course, Genesis 7, verses 19 and 21, "And the waters prevailed exceeding on the earth, and all flesh died that moved on the earth." Probably are familiar with coelacanths, since we're talking about fish. I can't help but talk about this. In another lesson that I have that's out there on YouTube, there is a lesson I give talking about evolution. And really, I really focus in on living fossils. And I talk about living fossils because it really shows problems for the evolutionary model. It shows that literally we have many fossils in the fossil record still alive and well today, preserved unchanged. And so the evolutionary process is broken. And we're not talking about thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years. We're talking up to 500 million years of broken evolutionary chain. It doesn't work. Coelacanth is one of those. Coelacanth was during the age of the dinosaurs. Coelacanth is found very often in the fossil record in various formations. But of course, it's a living fossil. We know it's alive and well today, but it was the poster child. Before Archaeopteryx, the poster child for evolutionists was coelacanth, the first evolutionary changed fish that came on land and became a tetrapod. It's still in the textbooks today. Literally, these are new textbooks out today and being used in the classrooms. Evolutionists will not give up. Even if it's wrong, they will not give up. And there are many things that they're still using today that some cringe over, but still push. Still push. Well, coelacantha is one of those. My point is living fossils. You know, watch that video. Look at some of the things. There's a book out called Living Fossils. Read up on those things because evolution is broken. But here's the deal. We have beautiful preservation of fossils just like today's species that looks just the same, is just the same, and is concurrent with the dinosaur fossils. And sometimes we find fossils that are even older. Here's a trilobite. Remember, trilobites go all the way back to the Cambrian explosion, 570 million years ago. They lived up to the time of dinosaurs. Supposedly, there was another life-ending event, according to the geologic record. There was some other extinction event and ended the trilobites. Well, trilobites are amazing. Trilobites are kind of interesting. And if you're a geologist, paleontologist, you get nerdy about them because they find such beautiful preserved elements of them. And you look at the intricate detail from the eye to the shape of the head, the face, how it rolls up like a little roly-poly. And it's a armament ultimately helps to protect it. You look at some that have antennae that's all over its body. You even see the underside where its legs and things are found. And you look at all of the anatomy of this creature. And this creature is not alive today. And if fossils never live, why would God go to the pain of creating such amazing species? And there are literally thousands of trilobite species. Why would he go to the pain of trying to show all of this intricate, creative detail, and none of it ever worked? Well, that's the problem. It did. These little critters are related to today's insects, even though they were interpreted as living on the bottom of the ocean. They look just like today's insects. They don't live on the bottom of the ocean, but you can see in the intricate elements of a multiplex of eye elements, such as found in this fly, to the roly-poly, to even this antennae with its segmentation looking just like this particular trilobite here. Actually, these things are very much in common. They have a lot in common, and they are creatively in common. And so why would these things be alive and preserved today and these never lived? Speaking of other things that are intricate and even sometimes fragile, we find bees, butterflies, dragonflies, grasshoppers, other insects beautifully preserved in the Mesozoic. This is the age of dinosaurs. Once again, same formations we find dinosaurs in. But these are alive and well today, and again, unaltered, unchanged. Then, of course, we do find iconic dinosaurs. We've learned a lot about them in recent years with discoveries. You see artistic representations on the left, but on the right, you see a dinosaur with down-like feathers. And we've learned a lot about feathered dinosaurs in the last few years. It's a very exciting area. They're learning a lot about it. Still trying to figure out how it all works in the evolutionary process and where they came from. Archaeopteryx is out. We've got to find something else. But then even skin textures, such as of this triceratop. And we see its particular armament skin texture. We wonder what it's completely made out of. This has been altered once again, but we start to get an idea of what kind of animal this was and what it must have looked like. Oh, wrong direction. And of course, I can't help but think of Job 41, verses 1 and 7. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Whatever that animal is, it's a very resilient animal. It's a scary animal. We don't know exactly what it is, but it certainly fits better context as this supposed idea, as it's an animal that is extremely intolerable to any kind of attack. And then we also find numerous dinosaur trace fossils. We find footsteps. We find them sometimes side by side. Sometimes it's adult with a child, an infant-type animal walking along with it. We find them crisscrossing, such as at river intersections. We find that they're huge, and sometimes we learn a lot about their stride and how muscular and how powerful they must have been based on the depressions that we find in the sand and the mud. We find things like Coprolites, that was discussed earlier. Coprolites can be found either in the digestive system or excreted. I had a beautiful example I wanted to bring tonight. Let the children handle and let them guess what it was. But it is supposedly a representation of what animals ate, that they digested things, that they ultimately excreted things. These are representations of activity, mobility, and even, in this case, digestion. But there is also examples of fertility. We find eggs. Recently, a nest of baby velociraptors was found. And it's very interesting to see them in their nesting ground and to see how they possibly interacted. A lot can be learned. And this is what paleontologists spend a lot of time trying to understand. Understand a lot about these animals and what was their activity in ancient times. These are some of my favorite examples. These are the horseshoe crab. The horseshoe crab actually began, it is also in my living fossil, one of the oldest living fossils we have, along with echinoderm, starfish. It goes all the way back to the early parts of the Cambrian. A half billion years ago, with very little change. Here are two apparently living animals that were scurrying across the sand and then rapidly buried. Here's a modern one, scurrying across the sand, making cute little designs on the shoreline. Here's the underside and some of the sizes that are represented in today's world. And you can see how they leave little footprints. And so here it is, a living fossil, going back a half billion years, been scurrying on the sand ever since. Now again, I don't agree with necessarily the ages, but if you look at the entire geologic stratigraphic column, and then you think about the fossil record, there is signs of life, and that these are simply former lives that are represented in the geologic record. And then it was mentioned earlier about Paluxy. I had contemplated whether I'd even show Paluxy, but it's at least worth sharing because there are those who believe that these things are real. There are those who believe that there are human tracks associated with dinosaur tracks. I'll propose to you this. Carl Baugh is the scientist that proposes and found supposedly the center track here and leads various expeditions out to look for more human prints and has stated there's over 100 prints that have been found down in the Paluxy River that are truly human. And he is one who is the curator of the Creation Museum that's down there. Well, I've talked to Carl Baugh. I would not call Carl Baugh a liar to his face. Carl Baugh is a geoscientist. He has a degree. He knows what he's looking for. He spent years down there doing research work. And even though I've not seen it all firsthand, in talking to him, he comes across as extremely genuine. Jimmy Cady and I had the chance to meet him and talk to him and interview him. And he showed us other things as well. But the point is he truly believes that these are human trackways and that they have been found. Of course, the one that is most debated is supposedly the Delk print, which has a human print that is ultimately superimposed with a dinosaur print on top of it, which means the dinosaur stepped second. And then they've done work. They've done CT scanning, which looks at that particular rock, looks for compressibility of the clay stones and things of that nature. When you see clay compressed in higher density, it means something pushed down on it and left it in that compressed state when it ultimately solidified. They've done their research. People may not like the results because it doesn't fit the modern paradigm in evolution, but they've tried to do the best they can with the evidences that they've discovered. And whether people agree with it, such as AIG and Ken Ham, doesn't matter. These things are out there, and there are others. And there are many others throughout the world, and they have been typically dismissed, and therefore we don't get the due diligence and research on them because most people don't want to know or things happen to these particular representations. Here's another one I'll share with you, and we're getting close to the end. But here is a Velociraptor and a Protoceratop. They are both about 5 to 6 feet in length, so don't let the scale of the screen fool you. These are big animals. In this particular depiction, which was unearthed in the Gobi Desert in Mongolia, China, we find literally two animals that were fighting and then suddenly preserved in the geologic record. You can see the little hook sunk into on the inside of the, here, I got a pointer, we can use it here, inside the rib cage of the Protoceratop. And this right here, very interestingly enough, Protoceratops got a big mouthful of Velociraptor. Of course, we think about the movies, and Velociraptor's got to be the worst. Well, this Protoceratop thinks differently. Here's a depiction of supposedly what happened, and there are little YouTube videos out there I find amazing. I clicked on one earlier because I wanted to know what the 2.5-minute video looked like. And they're fighting, and it's showing, oh, how scary these animals are. And suddenly, it's just an above view, and this debris and sand and material just buries them. That's the end of the picture, end of the video. Well, how'd they get buried? You think just dirt and debris fell from the sky and suddenly buried these two things that are fighting, going to just suddenly stop moving around? Some say, well, it was a sandstorm. Yeah, I can imagine people dying in a sandstorm with a, you know, Twix bar still in their mouth because they had nothing else to do at the moment that the sandstorm hit them. The point is these were preserved in a catastrophic event and literally fighting with one another. We find fossils with scars on the bones, cut marks, scrapes, scratches, bites. We even found record of fish, devouring fish in the marine record. It's interesting when you go through this. You see activity. You see animals eating animals. And of course, that is interesting in and of itself when you think about the biblical record. Because according to the Bible, Genesis 1:30, also, to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. It wasn't until after these events that man started to ultimately eat food and animals started to be meat eaters. And according to Romans 5:12 as well as 6:23, therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, death through sin. Ultimately, sin in the garden, the fall, created death. The first animals had to be sacrificed and killed to create tunics of skin for Adam and Eve. So before that, why would you have in the fossil record representations of death through killing and carnivorous activity if it wasn't even tolerated in the garden? Why would you have that? And that leaves a huge paradoxical question that I can't get around. And then finally, we'll share Dr. Mary Schweitzer's findings with the T-Rex MOR1125. It was a femur, about 42 inches in length, 195 pounds. It's interesting. This is a case and example, since Bart showed this and shared a different view, where scientists often look at the same evidence and come up with a different hypothesis. That happens a lot, and that's okay. That's what we do. We look at evidence and we try to interpret it. Well, in this case, my issue with the idea of this being just simply a fossil is it does have organic tissue on the inside. We define fossilization as an alteration. It's a chemical process. It is something that occurs. And what I think this is a representation of is what you see in the top right here is fossilization began, but because of the large size and the high density of this material, some of it did not fossilize on the inside and was encased, meaning it was going through the fossilization process but not complete itself all the way through the bone material. What was left was fibrous collagen, elastin, blood vessels, hemoglobin, and red blood cells. Right here are little red blood cells in a blood vessel. And to me, this is one of the most important things to give consideration to because the Bible clearly says in Leviticus 17:11, for the life of the flesh is in the blood. Where you have blood, you had life. And to me, this is one of the more conclusive elements of looking at the fossil record. Not only do you see activity, do you see all of these various things taking place, but at the end of the day, you ultimately see preservation of life, sometimes partial. In this case, you have both altered and slightly unaltered preservation of fossil material. You see them both in this particular example and case. And with those red blood cells, I do believe that is a representation of life. At the end of the day, you know, I'm not going to get into all the details about behemoth, but we have behemoth-like animals out there. This one here is an Argentinosaurus. You can think of where it comes from, Argentina. This is a massive creature. There's an elephant in comparison. Some people think behemoth was an elephant. Well, this animal would have been a behemoth of a behemoth. And if you look at this picture, looking at it straight on, down here in the bottom right, velociraptor, human. Big animal. Big animal. And of course, the scriptures in Job 40, verses 15 through 18. Look now and behold the behemoth, which I made along with you. There's a key element. He is a part of the creation. He moves his tail like a cedar. His bones are like beams of bronze. His ribs like bars of iron. The one thing I will say, my difference of view with Brother Bart's, which I respect. I love Brother Bart. Don't ever think otherwise. We love each other very much, and we will talk many, many more times about this stuff. But the behemoth definitely leaves some questions, such as with regard to the reeds, to being able to take the gushing Jordan, scale, things of that nature. But that cedar tail, things of that nature, I think there's some difference of view there. The point is it's an animal. I think it's an animal because when you roll out of the context of the preceding two chapters, three chapters, in fact, you come out of talking about the earth, its creation. It is creation talked about in chapter 38. 39 is talking about the creative things such as animals going into verse or chapter 39. And then 40 and 41 continue to follow on the heels in context, I think, concludes that that has to still be creative animals that were a part of the creation story, and that whatever it is that is being pointed out, it is something Job and his friends could have beheld. But in this case, the context is what Job could behold for himself. This last verse I'll share with you, and then I'll stop. Romans 1 and 20 is an important verse, and I'll quote NIV. It may not be the best interpretation. It leaves out Godhead, but it does get across some points I think are important because we can help summarize this idea. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. The essence of this verse is this. Since creation, God is clearly seen, being understood so that people are without excuse. If we go back to the original paradox of apparent age, how do you get to a position of being without excuse if it looks really old and doesn't look young and fit the creation account? If it looks really old, you may be going to another conclusion. You may think evolution works. You may think uniformitarianism works. You may think a lot of things, but you're not necessarily going to conclude, oh, wow, look at all the things God created, and aren't they amazing to behold? I think that can be confusing there. And again, it goes back to us. God is not the author of confusion. And I don't believe the apparent age theory clears up confusion. I think in this case, there is evidence. And when we ask the question, what does the fossil evidence tells us? I believe it tells us that the world was teeming with life, proof of God's creative power, lots of evidence of it. But you know what? Some things are not existent today because of the change of this world. And so we can go into a lot of those details. I'm sure we'll come out in some of the questions, but that's the things I presented had for you tonight. And so I hope it's been helpful. Thank you.